Tonight on Arena, we review Amnesiac, the new memoir from filmmaker Neil Jordan and artist Salvador Avlukin about his new exhibition, Fancy Situations. Is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch the live stream on rte.ie/arena. Neil Jordan was an acclaimed writer long before he became an acclaimed and indeed Oscar-winning filmmaker. His debut short story collection, A Night in Tunisia, came out in 1976. Accolades at the time included Sean O'Fuala, no less, comparing him to James Joyce, and the book won the Guardian Literature Prize. 6 years later, he directed Angel, his highly regarded first film, starring Stephen Murray as a musician caught up in a gangland murder in the north of Ireland. The rest, as they say, is history. Wide range of films that followed, including The Crying Game, Mona Lisa, Interview with a Vampire, Michael Collins, much else besides, all of which fans will give fans a twofold interest in his new memoir, Amnesiac. Paul Whittington has been reading it for us and he joins me in studio now. It's easy to have amnesia and forget that writing aspect to Neil Jordan.
Yeah.
It was a writing that won him an Oscar for The Crying Game.
Yeah.
But it was writing that kind of started him out on this artistic life, as it were.
Yeah, it was. And he, as you mentioned in the intro there, he showed great early promise and it looked like this path was set out for him as, you know, an Irish writer. But I think he found that quite constricting. And he says in the memoir that the moment he started writing a screenplay, he felt liberated from the kind of Irish literary tradition in single quotes that he found quite oppressive. And I think the other thing about, I have had the great misfortune to read a number of these type of memoirs that involve filmmakers, and the vast majority of them are badly written. This, of course, is really well written, and the most the Hollywood stuff is great, and he's quite funny about all that. But the best bits, the richest bits, are about his childhood, his family, and so forth.
Yeah, that's where he starts. In fact, he doesn't even start with this is childhood. He goes further back than that. He goes back to his grandparents and a potential link, in fact, to Michael Collins in London with his grandmother.
Yeah, who was a postmistress in London, and it is reckoned that Michael Collins was in Edgewood because I think he worked as a postman for her, which I didn't know, actually. And it's hard to imagine given our sort of heroic idea of him. But so there is that vague connection. He's very interested in his he remembers his grandmother. He remembers going out to his maternal grandmother, going out to Bray to see her when she wasn't well at the end of her life. And that established a strong connection with Bray for him, where he lived later himself. And this elusive grandfather, who was English, but was called O'Brien. So there was he wasn't entirely English, perhaps. And he was an artist. And his mother, there are some of her, as you've seen in sketches and paintings, book, she's a fine artist. And I think she communicated to Neil his...
So the visual side came from there.
Yeah, yeah.
And he talks about that child. So he starts with the grandparents and he does get into the childhood, and nary a difficulty to be really expressed within it, certainly in terms of his family.
In terms of family, I mean, I think that he had his mother, he bookends the book with his parents, and his mother in particular seems to have been very close to, and he's at the start of the book, he's talking about when she wasn't well towards the end of her life. His father, he was a very accomplished musician when he was a teenager, and that was from his father, but his father was a kigger with the
you know, the Scola.
Kigger Scola, and he was a bit sterner, and I think he felt like he had to live up to something with him. And in fact, he remembers going to Belgrove over in Clontarfrohini.
Yeah, because the family, they started out in Sligo, but they moved to Dublin.
They did, and they were in Slorgan, and he met Dermot Morgan, the mini Dermot Morgan briefly, which is very interesting, and then they moved over there, and he went to Belgrove, and he remembered John McGarren, who, of course, was run out of Belgrove by a mob, essentially, acting on church instructions. But he remembered him teaching him, and but he the way he describes, from a child's point of view, the park across the road, an old rundown house, and his imagination filled it with ghosts and goblins. He describes all that beautifully, and also the Ireland of the time and how sort of repressed it was.
Mm. Does he get much into religion, the Catholic Church, that given that, you know, McGahan was his teacher, does he get into much about that side of things?
Peripherally he does, because it's sort of omnipresent. It's more about the kind of sense, the sense of shame that seemed to be communicated to people, and the idea that everybody had to be very careful about everything. He talks about the Christian Brothers, which resonated with me a bit, and there's this great description of when they would hit you with the leather, the impact would be so much their own feet would be raised off the ground almost, and that there was no logic to it. So he remembered all that. So he was quite, and he says he didn't, you know, he wasn't terrific in school. He'd sit at the back and was watchful, but he seemed to be determined, as James Joyce had put it, to fly past the nets, and certainly that one of Catholicism.
Yeah, and he went off then to study in UCD, where amongst others he met the Sheridan brothers there.
He met the Sheridan brothers there. Yeah, he went there, and I think he was originally going to study literature, and he found that there was so much kind of analysis of books and not enough reading, so he switched to history. But he met Jim Sheridan, and like the nerve of them in the late 60s, when, you know, there wouldn't have been much going on in the performing arts, they started putting on plays and doing street performances, and he would, you know, wear costumes and play instruments, and they were out there. They thought that filmmaking was for French people. They had no sense they would ever get to.
Yeah, I think he talks about this idea, to write something you need a pen and a bit of paper.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of investment involved in that, in terms of financial investment.
Exactly.
But when it came to making films, you needed to have serious money. But interestingly, it was Excalibur and John Berman in the 1980s, wasn't it? Yeah.
79, I think.
Yeah,
and
he was taken in on that as a writer, as a doctor, a writing doctor.
Well, and a kind of unofficial one. I think there are probably an awful lot of people in Ireland who learnt their trade on John Borman films, particularly that one. And of course, Liam Neeson was in that film in a not very large role. He took a shine to Jordan, and he began showing the scripts, and he would work on the scripts, and he also very generously, as Neil says in the book, he gave him the time and a camera to make a documentary, and he learned how to make films doing that, because he never went to film school.
Yeah.
He learned how to do it doing that.
Yeah, and it's amazing that Berman was the one who gave him his
And
choice.
Berman also produced his first film, of course, as well.
Which was Angel, which was the beginning of a long relationship with the actor Stephen Ray. Does he go into how they met and
He had seen him on stage, and obviously he was well known as a stage actor, but he talks about the quality of stillness that... Mm. Which is a very interesting way of describing what's special about Stephen Ray. And he wanted him for his first film, and he was available for his first film, and they just seemed to understand each other.
Yeah, Angel was that first film. But the big breakthrough, of course, came with The Crying Game. When you think of where we are now in contemporary Ireland around trans rights and just an awareness of that whole situation, he was miles ahead of the posse in the story he was telling in The Crying Game.
Yeah, well, I think in a way what he was about in that. I mean, he's made quite clear that he was no particular fan of violent republicanism, and he wanted to undercut the Stephen Rees character's sort of identity and sense of himself as very much this kind of, you know, I am an IRA man.
So the IRA man, and so, they have a British soldier is holding him hostage.
Yes, exactly. And the soldier is killed, and he goes to London then, and he finds the soldier's girlfriend, and he feels bad. He doesn't reveal his part in the whole thing instantly. But what Jordan wanted to do, he thought, what better way to detonate, you know, an Irish Republican sense of himself than for the person to be transgender.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to a clip, which is a moment when the Fergus character goes into the pub in London seeking Dill, the girlfriend of the British soldier, and the barman here is played by Jim Broadbent.
So, you say you're a regular, sir?
Is that good or bad?
Well, you get to say the usual, Carl, things like that. Here. Let's call this the usual.
Thanks.
No, it's on me.
Thanks very much.
You can take it out if you want. Came to see her, didn't you? Listen, there's something I should tell you. She's Swat. It's on.
Very nicely giving us the title of the film, The Crying Game, which of course won Neil Jordan an Oscar for writing. There's the writing in there again. We're speaking about Neil Jordan's new memoir, which is called Amnesiac. Forgot what it was he was talking about there. And very interestingly there, we heard Jay Davison as Dale at the end of that singing The Crying Game, the song itself. We nearly didn't get The Crying Game because of a row with Harvey Weinstein over the casting of Jay Davison.
Yeah, he was dead against it. He wanted the character to be played by a woman. The whole point of the film would then be undercut. But he makes the point that Harvey Weinstein had so much clout then everybody wanted to work with him. They were very afraid of him, so he tended to get what he wanted. And in fact, he says at the end of the second chapter on this film that a lot of people didn't get paid what they should because of the Weinsteins, but they got away with it because everybody wanted to work with them again. If you fell out with them, you were kind of done.
Yeah.
And it was Derek Jarman, I think, who told Jordan about Jay Davison and about who wasn't an actor, and he likes non-actors because they bring something totally fresh and they wake up the actors because the actors can't just be comfortably them. They actually, something else might happen. So of course it worked brilliantly.
Yeah. You were saying that part of the strongest sections of the book, of the memoir for you, Paul, are the sections that deal in and around Hollywood. I mean, big Hollywood stars that he got in an Interview with a Vampire, which was immediately after The Crying Game, but it was quite close to it.
Because of The Crying Game.
Yeah,
the Crying Game wasn't supposed to do anything, and it did. And so suddenly he had clout much more than he had done because they were mainly British-backed films he'd made before. And then he was doing Interview with the Vampire, and there was great furore over the casting of Tom Cruise, and Anne Rice said it was like casting... Who wanted him to make the film said that it was like casting Edward G. Robinson as Rhett Butler, but she did recant and she took out a page in Variety apologising, so she thought that was a touch of class. But this is a big film, he's in LA, he describes it with kind of Chandler-esque flourishes, Los Angeles, that's great the way he writes it, I think I'm sure that's deliberate, and like they're closing bridges and it's just a film on a vast scale, and poor Brad Pitt is bored. But it's too nice to say so. But he's very complimentary about Cruise because he says if Cruise says he'll do something, he does it.
Yeah, professional.
And he suggests that's quite unusual over there.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Let's have a listen to a clip from Interview with a Vampire. This is Claudia, played by Kirsten Dunst, a little bit frustrated about her own identity and not being told about herself here. And she's confronting the Tom Cruise character here, and she's looking for answers.
But it wasn't always so. I had a mother once. And Louis, he had a wife. He was mortal, the same as she, and so was I.
Claudia!
You made us what we are, didn't you?
Stop her, Louis.
Did you do it to me? How did you do it?
Why should I tell you? It's in my power.
Why yours alone? Tell me how it was done.
Be glad. You are.
You'd be dead now if I hadn't.
Like that damned corpse. Now get rid of it!
You get rid of it.
That's Kirsten Dunst and Tom Cruise there in a scene from Interview with the Vampire. As we were listening to that, Paul, Brad Pitt is there in the background, sitting passively watching it all, which was kind of what frustrated him about the whole thing, wasn't
it? I think the role was quite a passive role, and I think that he found that quite difficult. It was nothing to do with the production went like that, so it got him down a bit, I think. But I think Jordan says it all went very well.
But as you say, a lot of people turning up their nose at
Cruise. Oh, yeah.
But when you look at Cruise and that, you see that, you know, there obviously is an actor and a film
star. Absolutely, yeah.
The two are present in that particular film. Along comes Michael Collins then. I mean, how do you make a film like Michael Collins in Ireland without offending? Well, no matter what you say, you're going to annoy somebody.
Well, it was just remarkable. I mean, I don't know if you could do it now, never mind then. Mm. The fact that he was able to do it, and they used, was it Grange Gorman they used?
For
the shell, which
that.
Is the brilliant, the best scene.
Oh, for the GPO.
The
yeah.
shell of the GPO with them standing inside it. And which is brilliant, but like the vision that he had, but he soon realised that like everybody had an opinion, and People here were condemning it before it ever came out. And then, of course, there was the whole that Alan Rickman that later on was so good as De Valera. If you watch it again, he was so good. And people weren't happy about that, of course, because the Civil War will we ever get over it? But it was very fresh then, and people were annoyed about this and annoyed about that. And Liam Neeson was too tall, or he wasn't tall enough, or he was too older. But I think that it was remarkable that he managed to do it. There was a lot of controversy as well over Julia Roberts, who he said was great. But if Julia Roberts hadn't been in it, it wouldn't have got made.
Well, sorry, I suppose it might have been made for an Irish audience, but it wouldn't have got much. That would have dictated a whole different level of budget. Let's listen to Michael. We need to know about the sod of turf here, this particular
it's
scene.
It's on fire, isn't it?
Yes.
He's motivating the troops, isn't he? His guerrilla army.
And he's got the sod of turf on fire in his hand as he does. A little bit of language in the midst of this.
We'll come out of the crowd, strike the enemy and vanish back into the crowd again.
What do you propose we strike with?
What have you got? Show me. Look at this, Eric. Same old story.
You need something better.
Sean, where's that police barracks?
2 miles down the road.
2 miles down that road, there's an arsenal.
Where the fuck are we supposed to get in? We haven't even got bullets.
Yeah, but they don't know that. What's that?
A sort of turf.
Wrong. That's a weapon. Fucking deadly. You don't believe me? What is it now?
There you go. Liam Neeson as Michael Collins in the Neil Jordan film of the same name. We're speaking about Amnesiac, the Neil Jordan memoir with Paul Whittington this evening. The fact that it's called Amnesiac, does he question his own memory, or does he just say that this is how I remember it and that's that?
No, he does. He kind of has a Proustian caveat at the beginning where he goes, because he's talking about Sligo and how he remembers it, and he's going, he doesn't trust his memory, basically. And he kind of plays with that theme, and he does talk and around his parents and how his memories of them change over time and all that. And he does talk about actually how he after his father
died quite suddenly, didn't he?
Yeah, he was fishing in a river up in Laytown, I think, or somewhere like that, and which had family connections, and he had a heart attack and he died on the spot, and Neil Jordan remembers he was sort of shaking Princess Anne's hand at a Hollywood premiere at the time, but he says he was on a plane and he saw his ghost, and he talks quite frankly about that, as he does about everything. Like if he mentions a lot of names, you just know it's not name dropping. He doesn't care. He's just describing situations. But he's very touching about that.
And when you speak to him, anytime I've spoken to him, there's kind of a droll delivery and a matter-of-fact nature. Does that come across in the writing in the book?
You hear his voice is very distinctive, and you hear it all the time. And I can't stress enough how good the writing is in this book. Mm. It's so unusual for somebody to be talking about Hollywood and be such a good writer. But the stuff about Ireland in the 60s and 70s is brilliant.
One final thing. Stanley Kubrick gets a big...
He does.
Hit. They're pals, are they?
Yeah, well, in the way that Stanley was pals with, I mean, the phone calls, and Stanley seemed to have great recall about daughters' names and so on, but he apparently recorded all the phone calls, but he tells great stories about Stanley Kubrick, who sort of pops in and out, and also tells stories about the films he didn't get to make, like King Lear with Marlon Brando. Imagine what that would have been.
Wow. Oh, well, pity he didn't get to make that. is he looking forward, or does he just put a full stop at the end? That's where I am right now.
Well, actually, he mentions his next project. He mentions a film that he's going to be making. So his compulsions continue, which is great news for everybody.
Maybe Amnesiac to be continued. Let's finish up with Sinead O'Connor. The use of Sinead O'Connor and her voice in Michael Collins is just extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He got a lot of things right in that film, I think. And if you listen to that scene we just got to there, there's something very sort of non-pompous and under and very well written about the way it's done.
Yeah, and I think the moment here is Julia Roberts is about to be told that Michael Collins has been shot, and this is what we hear as that is happening. Thanks very much, Paul.
My mother, my mother.
could say it will not be long, love, till our wedding day.
Voice of Sinead O'Connor there in the film Michael Collins. And before that, Paul Whittington was talking to us about the new Michael Collins memoir, which is called Amnesiac, and it is published by Head of Zeus. Hailing from Dublin, more specifically Lucan, artist Salvador Fulham is known for his vibrant, raw, often deeply personal works that explore themes of identity, belonging and the human condition. He mainly makes work about his own life, often figurative domestic scenes. He's of mixed race, half Bangladeshi, half Irish, and throughout his life he has been asked, where is he from? He's always replied, Lucan. So he decided to simply call himself Salvatore of Lucan, a former winner of the Zurich Portrait Prize. His most recent exhibition, Fancy Situations, is currently on display in the Kevin Kavanagh Gallery. And I'm delighted that Salvatore is with me in studio this evening. You were saying as we were coming to air about your nan had given you very specific instructions about how you were to behave on air, etc. Salvatore, you grew up in your nan's house.
I did, yeah. Yeah, with my mum, my nan, and my auntie and my sister.
Yeah, so it was very much a house of women.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
What kind of artistic background was there within the house?
I'd say everyone in my family is quite artistic, but not really practicing or whatever. But I remember my uncle's paintings were all around the house, and until he was about 25, he made surrealist paintings that were always on the walls in the house, and I was really like them, or like was trying to decode them.
Yeah, so and he wasn't a professional artist. This was just something he did for fun, before himself.
He became a computer engineer, yeah.
And describe the nature of those paintings, because I think they probably have had quite a long standing effect on your own work.
Probably, yeah. There's quite a lot of sort of people in agony or like faces floating or people that you would definitely recognizable as my nan or as him there was a kind of a lot of floating symbols basically that I would read into as being.
So even though they were quite abstract, you were already seeing members of your family or very much the domestic situations that you painted in quite a figurative way yourself now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of. Yeah. Maybe I think they are there. I think I remember my auntie kind of going like, oh, that's telling me who she thought people were in the pictures. And being when you're a kid, you have a good imagination anyway. So.
Yes. And when did painting, or how quickly or how soon did painting and drawing and art expression of that visual nature become part of your life?
Definitely when I was a kid, it was kind of all I got praised for. So then you want to do it more.
Was this at school?
At school, like from primary school, I used to win the art competitions. And then then as I got older, I kind of thought it was definitely a way to impress people or something. I'd draw people in my class, or I'd do silly drawings of the teacher or something, and it would get you get a reaction. Mm. This was, yeah.
And these were, it was about a likeness, was it about a very figurative representation of things
you were
looking
at? I suppose, yeah, it was a likeness and then a situation attached to that that would be funny, I suppose.
So you add, given that the new exhibition is called Fancy Situations, there was always a kind of a situation aspect to whatever the portrait was.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. I think that gets that's the kind of important bit really, isn't it? Or maybe, I don't know, actually, yeah.
Yeah, so it isn't just about getting somebody to sit down on a chair in front of you and you paint a likeness of them.
Yeah.
You're putting them into situations. That is pretty much part of it.
Exactly, yeah. Although, I do like straight portraits, but maybe I'm slightly bored by them.
Now, it was, how would you describe the portrait that won you the Zurich Portrait Prize in 2021?
That's a painting of my ma healing me. My ma studies Reiki and sound healing.
Yeah, so we'll tweet that image actually as you're speaking about it here at RTE Arena if you want to see. This is my ma healing me. So we see you on a couch or a bed in this, Salvatore, and it has to be said, you do look as if you need a bit of healing.
It's kind of a weird lounger that my ma has in her room. Like, it's like a garden lounger that she puts you on before she practices her sound healing. But yeah, what was the question again?
I was saying about just that you do look as if you need some healing. Oh,
exactly. Yeah. No, and I think, I still live at home, and when my mom was practicing more, she's got a job now where she's back too late to practice usually, or she's packing airplane meals in Swords or something, and she has to go from Lucan. Anyway, I don't know why I'm talking about that. Usually when she would practice on me is when I was hungover and just spending the whole day in bed, and she'd go like, come up here like you're doing nothing. Yeah. I'm always flying around pretending I'm busy.
Yeah, and I wonder about, you mean, because this is a self-portrait, well, it's you and your ma, obviously. How do you visualise that? I mean, were you looking at a mirror? Did you get somebody to take a photograph of it? Or do you just imagine it in your own head?
I suppose I imagined it initially for the composition, like from my head, and then I took photos of my ma, and then separately took photos of myself on a timer. And then it was actually during lockdown, and I was staying in my studio a lot instead of going back to Lucan. And I got my sister to go in and take photos of the room so that I could fill in the detail.
Now, you had studied in NCAD, I think, at this point. How important was the winning of the Zurich Portrait Prize for you in 2021?
I think it was great. Like, it made people it made me feel like people might think that I was important or something.
And the commissions, though, that came from that, and the specific work that grew out of it.
Yeah.
What came?
Oh, what came? Oh, like, I have to do... I don't think I'm allowed to say who I'm doing for the okay. National Gallery portraits.
Right.
But it is done and they have it. It just hasn't been launched. And, I've started getting more commissions, and I suppose that's the only way you're going to make a living.
And how, do you do with those, and I know you can't tell me the specifics of the person, but do you put people into situations when you want to paint them? How do you make that connection rather than just sit down in that chair and I'll paint a straight portrait?
I suppose it's kind of like, or like, you know, like the thing, like society makes the man or society makes the person. I think, I like just thinking of, or like a prop, like making a prop an obstacle for someone, or that's kind of, it's kind of like slapstick.
So you are putting them almost into, not quite situation comedy, but you're putting them into a situation where you can therefore see something about them that you wouldn't see if they were just posing.
Exactly, and just kind of imagining them in the situation. Yeah.
Tell me about the moment that Salvatore of Lucan became the name, because I think it's in and around your meeting your father. You hadn't met your father until you were
married. I met my dad in 2018. And I went to New York to meet him, and I remember being in his Airbnb. He lived in Florida, and I was in his Airbnb in New York, and he was cooking this dinner, me and my ex-girlfriend. And I got an email to say that I'd got a show in Palace Projects, so that was going to be like my first ever solo show in 2018.
Big moment.
And then straight away I just realised that I think I'd been signing my painting Salvatore Fulham of Lucan, and then once I found out that I was going to get to show them, I was like, no, I'm just Salvatore of Lucan now. I'll do that.
And you wanted Lucan very much to be part of that name. Why was that so important to you?
It's the best place on earth, basically.
And you're not biased?
No, not at all.
Was it around that meeting with your father that you also gave us the self-portrait, me pregnant with my inner child?
That's in my new show. Yeah.
So I'll tweet that image at RTE Arena again to see this particular image. Tell me a little bit about what was going on in this portrait for you, this self-portrait for you, Salvatore.
I can't really remember where it came from, but I remember I got this box of like plastic cactuses from IKEA, and I really liked them for some reason. I never took them out of the box, and I just thought, these plants in this box was quite interesting. And then that's kind of like something growing within a vessel. And then I don't know how I came to like think me pregnant, but when I did it just made sense. And then I kind of deformed I've deformed the face, but it's also unformed, or like, it was kind of trying to express, Ooh, it's a hard one.
Yeah, I know. I suppose if you could put it into words, you wouldn't be a visual artist. You would be a writer, I guess.
Is the
answer to that. But again, what interests me in this, I know that Bacon, you were very interested in Francis Bacon. Egon Schiele, I think, was quite important to you early on, when I was a kid.
As well.
But I can still see part of that influence is in there. So while this is a figurative portrait, there obviously is a slightly off-kilter quality to it as well.
Yeah, I suppose Bacon's massively about deformation. And then, I suppose when you're thinking about pregnancy, it's kind of unformed being a very similar thing. So, yeah, I know, I like the idea of me being unformed and being pregnant with an unformed.
Well, there you go. And that is all within the exhibition. Thanks so much for coming into us this evening and best of luck with the exhibition. That's Salvatore of Lucan. Fancy Situations is the title of his new exhibition. It's showing at the Kevin Kavanagh Gallery and it's there through until June the 29th. More information at kevinkavanagh.ie. Now, in spite of the weather, it's a sure sign that summer has arrived in Dublin City when the RHA, the Royal Hibernian Academy's exhibition, opens up at its gallery on Ely Place. Works from members of the Academy rub shoulders with established artists, the avant-garde, with pieces by aspiring artists who are invited to the show. Jess Fahey has been to the RHA to look at the rooms of artworks. She's with me in studio this evening. The 194th annual exhibition. It has quite the history, this particular exhibition, annual exhibition, Jess.
It does. So it was formed by Royal Charter back in 1823, and it took a very long time for it to really sort of become in any way modern, should we say. So in the 20th century in particular, there was a real anti-modernist feeling to the exhibition and the annual exhibition, which is supposed to be submissions from all artists, you know, that's supposed to be open. But it tended to be quite conservative, quite traditional, which is why then in 1942, the Irish Exhibition of Living Art was set up to give space to modern artists.
In and around Louis Le Brocq was one of the...
Yes.
Snubbed at the time, was he?
Yeah, he was. He had a painting called The Spanish Shawl that was rejected, and his mother, Sybil Le Brocq, decided then that that was enough, and she was going to get a group of people together to put on a separate exhibition. Now, you have to say today, the same is not true. You know, the diversity of the exhibition now is so different to the problems they had in the 20th century, and they're definitely making up for it.
So if it's a big, wide, open submission like that, they must receive works that just they simply can't use all of them.
Yeah, so it's over 5,000 submissions. And I think the way it works is the first round is through email, and then they will then call a certain lower amount of those in for physical display for their panel of judges. And then they make selection out of that. So I think in total, there's 515 works at this one. But of those, 346 are the submission works. So the others are from RHA members or invited artists.
When you have an exhibition of that size, are you looking for a linking theme? Do you kind of put bundles of paintings together that somehow speak to each other? How do you go about that? And who does that for this particular, for this year?
Yeah, so the curators, Donal Teskey and Vera Clute, are responsible for the organisation and the hanging of the exhibition. In the past, it had more kind of themes, certainly based on materials. So you might have one room that was just photography. This year, it's much more interspersed, which I think I actually prefer. So I think it's interesting to see contrasting things beside each other, not just same with same. And in particular this year, the sort of main gallery upstairs had often been reserved just for the RHA members, whereas now they're interspersed with the other, you know, new submissions and younger artists or new artists or self-taught artists. And again, that's really interesting to see. You know, I think that works so much better, you know, for my own personal enjoyment of it than it being, you know, the professional singled out separately.
Right, and there's also a large prize associated with this exhibition, isn't there?
In total, the prize fund, which is a series of different prizes, is €78,000, which making it the highest prize fund for any exhibition in Ireland, which of course for artists is so necessary, you know, to get that kind of accolade, but also then the funding and the money that comes with that and that recognition. And again, remember, this is an exhibition that anyone could submit to. You could do it next year, I could do it, you know, and it really just gives such a great opportunity and chance for people.
And you were saying just before we came to air that in fact there is a prize fund, obviously, but these paintings are for sale, and they're for sale online as well, as you don't have to necessarily be in the place in the gallery itself to buy.
Yeah, exactly. And the price is an extraordinary range. So it goes from about €50 to 60,000. So, I mean, something for everyone. And I was amazed. I mean, I was in there last week and it was red sticker, red sticker, red sticker. So they're selling, which is fantastic as well.
Well, that's, I mean, that is that, and that, that as well as the prize fund is vital for the artists. You know, they need to be bought and they need to be put somewhere.
Yeah.
All right. So you have been walking around the galleries for us. How did you wade through 500 plus paintings to choose the ones? Because I must say you gave us some illustrations to look at, and they're all very striking.
Yeah, it's very difficult. And I kind of went in on my first round of not looking for the name of the artist or anything like that, just seeing what struck me or what I was drawn to or interested in. And then I did kind of a second loop where very different work started to show themselves. And then I kind of thought about for this, maybe dividing them up by materials. So there's a good representation of both sculpture, painting, print, etc., which is a good representation then of the RHA, because you'll have everything from embroidery to, you know, glass sculpture to bronze to oil, watercolor, printmaking, you know, everything. So I kind of tried to divide it by those, but it was still difficult. And I still want to talk about 100 more than I will
Then we will get a chance to do. However, we will tweet some of the images as we go along. And I have to thank Paul O'Brien for the title of his work, which is called Another Shit Idea. It's a kinetic sculpture, 3D printed resin, at RTE Arena to see images of these as we're talking about them. Talk to me a little bit. First of all, what are we looking at in Paul O'Brien's? It's a kinetic sculpture then,
So it very much represents its title. So there is a brain with, actually, if you look at it closely, the pink kind of shape of the brain spells out the title, Another Shit Idea, on both sides.
Oh, right. And then, I can see that now.
Yeah, but it takes a second to see it. Yeah. And then on top of this brain, this big pink brain, there is a rotating little turd.
When I looked at it briefly and quickly, I thought, oh, it's a cap on top of a brain.
No.
But no, you realise that it's not quite a cap. It is feces, a little turd sitting up on top. Obviously a bit of humour at play in this.
See, this is the thing, and it's what I love, because I don't think art is just serious, because humans aren't just serious. So the fact that there's silly things, there's funny things, there's entertaining things, surprising things, it just is why the exhibition is always so great to go to.
And I think the contrasting piece that you put besides, again, this is a glass. Do we refer to it as a glass sculpture, or what do we refer to it as?
Yeah, glass work or glass sculpture, and it is exquisitely beautiful.
It's a Kitty Spears. Here's a piece called Fading Call of the Curlew at RTE Arena. Again, to see this. It looks so delicate and so fine, even in its image.
I don't know how they even transport something like that. So it's almost like outlines in glass that look like flowing streams of water.
What kind of size is this piece?
Life size for the bird.
Right.
Yeah. And that's in the same room as the brain one. So they're having these two next to each other. And it's just this incredible skill and talent to make something that fragile and that, you know, evocative of the animal. And then it makes you think about the title, this idea of the fading call, the fragility of the object reflecting, you know, the endangered species and the idea of what we have to think about in terms of nature.
And that's what you were saying about the two curators, Vera Clute and Donald Teskey. One of the things that they've done then is this contrasting pieces beside each other. And as you said, that in and of itself, you see both pieces differently when you look at them separately, but then beside each other.
Exactly.
You see both pieces in new ways.
Yeah. And it's the serious with the daft, you know, and again, a proper representation of what art is and how many multiple ways of creating art or of expressing different types of ideas. So having them next to each other, I think, was great. And generally, the mixture of the sculpture with other visual arts and photography and painting and things as well, again, is a great achievement on behalf of the curators. In some instances, like one wall, they have just small scale works, and they're all vastly different in terms of subject matter and style and technique, but they're all on one wall. And that works incredibly well, I think, as well, just using scale as the, you know, the thing they have in common. And then occasionally you might, you know, as you go around the exhibition, there might be a portrait next to a portrait, some things that relate. But I think most of the time it's more of a contrast, which is really interesting.
And all media are represented in the exhibition. Drawing is vital to this. Were there drawings that stood out for you?
Yeah, so there's so many and they're so beautiful. And it actually goes to the RHA's motto, which the translation from Latin is, at no day without a line. So in other words, to become a great artist, you have to draw all the time. Mm. We can think of so many famous artists who, you know, sketched constantly in notebooks and things. In the case here, they're much more highly finished works. So there's examples of, say, for example, a work called Daffodil by Robert Brandt, which he's actually made in black pen. And it's a blown up daffodil, a very large. From a distance, it almost looks like a photograph. And when you get up close, you realize that the skill and dedication, this sort of meticulous way of creating something. In other cases, the line or the sketch can be abstracted or much more loose or more free. So again, a vast array of different types of use of that technique.
You have, and again, I had to look twice at this particular piece, Costume. By Colin Murphy. I thought, oh, this is a piece of photography, but no.
No, it's a painting. And it has a little bit of the Etna Jordan feel to it. And Etna Jordan, as a RHA member, two of her works are in the exhibition.
Again, we'll tweet this Colin Murphy image at RTE Arena. Maybe describe it to us, first of all.
Yeah, so it's a sort of battered black leather couch. So a painting in oil of a battered black leather couch in an empty room. And behind the couch, there's plastic boxes saying wigs or other types of costumes. So at first it just seems like something very mundane, kind of familiar. Certainly the couch to me seemed very familiar. And then in that sort of empty space, he kind of creates the sense of this being a place of creation and imagination by him entitling the work Costume. So we think about the use of the space and the room. And I think that's something that's, you know, a lovely thing to kind of experience with the artist. They're showing you just something very everyday, and yet you get to add so much more to it by what ideas it might bring to you.
And another one that has that kind of hyper-realism within it is Harvest Thanksgiving by Debbie Godsell.
So that is a photograph, so arranged objects put together. And as an art historian, it particularly tickled me because it has the look of the 17th century Dutch banquet.
Absolutely, at RTE Arena to see an image of the Debbie Godsell photograph.
Yes, but instead of it being, you know, Murano glass or, you know, beautiful pieces of gold work, we have Angel Delight and, you know, other more contemporary objects and bizarre things in it. But it's that kind of dialogue with art history in that particular work, which is so good. And it's a large work and it's striking.
Yeah.
And that sort of feeling that in the same way in the Dutch 17th century, something like that, people would feel, you know, that really is in the room, that it's that believable. This photograph does the same kind of thing.
I think the piece of hyperrealism, the other piece of hyperrealism that, in fact, I was thinking of was Plastic Bag with Easy Peelers. This is a Connor Walton image, but this is a painting.
It is. But the,
again, extraordinary.
The most extraordinary thing about this one is that from a distance, it looks more hyperrealistic. And as you get closer, it becomes more painterly.
It's a plastic bag with Easy Peeler oranges inside.
Yeah, but it tells us so much about us and how we live and what we do. And it's like those kind of works, I think, are fascinating as a glimpse into our everyday life, just like we'd look back to 17th century Dutch through their paintings. And it's a beautiful piece, you know, the colour of the orange being so bright. But it's one definitely worth going to see, because when you look closer, it's very deceptive how he's painted it.
Talk to me a little bit about this is a print, I think, isn't it? And print is represented across the several rooms in the exhibition as well. A Night by Grainne Coff.
Yes.
Yeah, at RTE Arena to see the image.
Similar to the daffodil when I was talking about a moment ago, it's a large scale, a little bit more stylized flower, I think, but possibly a tulip. And it's in this deep, dark purple, and it is an etching. And it's again one of those that takes a little bit more time. time to sort of explore it and get up closer to it, has a different impact from a distance. Even the artist's writing, you know, their signature is beautifully done on that particular one. And I liked it just for its boldness. And again, having something like that to compare then to that black and white image of the daffodil or other versions of flowers. And it just shows you how every artist can take something like a flower and make it their own.
The other aspect of, I think, of this exhibition at the RHA annual exhibition is it is a chance, perhaps members of the Academy who have died during the year, it's a chance to see some of their works and to remember and you know, honour them in that particular fashion. Any of that as part of this year's exhibition?
There was indeed, yeah, as there always is. And this year it was, of course, Imogen Stewart, Dr. Peter Harbison, Walter Verling, so they're the main ones. Oh, David Hone as well. So in the case of Imogen Stewart, for example, they had a selection of different works, beautifully carved, as you know, she's well known for, one that was wooden and another that was kind of in a granite stone as well, and then various different representations of paintings of the other artists. So it is a lovely memorial to those who were previously involved as members and even, you know, presidents and things of the exhibition.
Yeah, and all sorts of sizes, as you said, of works here. But I think, I don't know if it's possibly one of the largest pieces that's so. There is one from Liam Belton. He had a large piece last year as well, and a monumental work, Humane to Paint and Protest, from Liam Belton at RTE Arena to see this image. It looks enormous, even in a small reproduction of it. It looks enormous.
Yeah, it takes up a whole wall. Very, very striking. As you come into the room, your curiosity certainly is drawn to it to try and understand what it is. It has a real feeling of a kind of Francis Bacon studio, but just like a section of it, where you almost feel the action of the artist and the almost sort of archaeology of an artist's studio, all, you know, included and impacted with paint onto the surface.
Yeah, but what size must his studio be, and the transportation of that piece?
A good point. Yeah, absolutely. They're going to, and that must be so difficult to move around. It must come out in sections or something like that, I would imagine. But the right hand side, it looks almost like fire damage. It's all black and white, and there's an old like typewriter, so it's mixed media, so there's actual objects in it as well. And then that gradually goes over to more bright and exuberant colours, and then it's collage like with little pieces of cut out from newspaper or replicas of paintings, and endlessly interesting to look at and pick apart. It's a really fascinating one.
I don't know I never know quite how to approach the annual exhibition, you know, because you can't go in and take it all in one go. It's a several visits type of scenario, really, isn't it? This one
absolutely is, yeah. And a different thing will draw you every time. Another one of the ones that really grabbed me, because as I walked into one of the first rooms, I could see a sculpture that had my hair, the same curly hair as me, which immediately drew me over to look at it. Yeah. And to my horror, as you walk around it, because you start by seeing it from the back, which I think is intentional, as you walk around the front, and this is by Sive Moulds, and the face is missing, and it's just this sunken sort of vortex.
Yeah, actually, very, we'll tweet that. It's called The Weight at RTE Arena. Yeah,
yeah. So, I mean, for me, that was certainly one of the first ones to grab me, and I do want to keep going back to it. And I think it would have a similar effect to anyone. You don't necessarily have to have the same hair.
Yeah,
but it's those kind of works that, you know, are kind of maybe shocking when you first see them, that you need to revisit. And then certainly on the second visit for me to look at that one, the actual skill and artistry came to the fore once I was over the shock, kind of thing.
And again, where you might be drawn one direction on your first visit, and then that kind of dictates how you see the exhibition, where you go first, you could be drawn in a totally different way at the second or third time.
Exactly.
You go to see it.
And I think anyway with art, you know, and with any visitor, what you're interested in would be very different to what I'm interested in. What mood you might be in the day you go could draw you to different things. You might be more melancholic or more, you know, into looking at something tranquil, whatever it may be. But it feels, it's sort of like information overload if you try and see it all. Yeah. And it's definitely something, it's on until the 4th of August. So people can go back and visit different rooms or look at different artists or aspects.
And that argument that we are, that kind of controversy that was there for a long time about that it's a very conservative exhibition, even from the range of stuff you've spoken to us about on the programme now. That argument is gone now.
It is. I would argue since really the 1970s onwards has been a massive shift in the sort of ideas of, you know, what's allowable. And I think they're just constantly actually really pushing the boundaries of what is allowed to be art or included in art.
All right, Jess, thanks so much for that. Jess Fahey, being to see the 194th Royal Hibernian Academy of Arts Open Submission Exhibition, currently on display at the Royal HA Gallery on Ely Place in Dublin till the 4th of August, you're saying there, Jess, and rhagallery.ie will give you full details on that. Now, last night, I forgot to announce the competition winner for two tickets to Circle Mirror Transformation by Annie Baker at the Gate Theatre and the overnight stay in the Croke Park Hotel, leaving you on tender hooks. I'm sure you've been waiting for me to say it all night. Apologies on that. Let me make up for that now and say, the question, of course, was Niamh Cusack plays the character of Marty in Circle Mirror Transformation. Which famous actor was Niamh's father? The answer was, of course, the great Cyril Cusack. And the winner of the competition is Tom Schnitger. Congratulations to you on that, Tom. Enjoy the play and the overnight stay. That is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. And Faith No Brain On will be with you after the news.